The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Thursday, August 14th, 2008. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, another record year for A-level results.
The message from everyone who runs the application system at UCAS is stay incredibly calm today. Don't rush into grabbing the first place you can get through the clearing system.
More by-election bother for Gordon Brown. David Cameron dismisses claims that Northern cities should give up and residents should emigrate down south.
I think the idea that cities cannot regenerate themselves, that if they were built for one purpose, they cannot carry out another purpose, I think is just nonsense.
We hear some interesting findings from Ofcom's latest report on Britain's use of the media. Plus, an Olympic update direct from Beijing. First, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
President Bush has sent American troops to Georgia to oversee a vigorous and ongoing humanitarian mission. It's in a direct challenge to Russia's display of military dominance over the region. The move comes after the Kremlin's soldiers moved into two strategic Georgian cities in what the US and Georgian officials called a violation of the ceasefire Russia had already agreed to. US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is set to hold talks in the Georgian capital Tbilisi later.
The honest thing to do here is to call it as you see it. And what we see is that what has been a long-standing and somewhat volatile conflict did, in fact, boil over. That could have been handled, but now Russia has pushed this well beyond the bounds of the conflict in South Ossetia. And that's what the president was reacting to. That is why people are questioning the nature of the ongoing relationship with Russia. That's why people are talking about consequences for the kind of relationship that Russia has wished to build with the international community.
Universities are bracing themselves for a new A-level record. An unprecedented number of straight A students will trigger the toughest ever scramble for places. As more than 300,000 pupils find out their results, the number of top grades awarded is predicted to rise for the 17th year running. One of the most senior admissions officers in England has disclosed that more pupils were meeting their offers than in previous years. Jeff Parks from Cambridge University says it gives them little flexibility to consider pupils who missed their results because of issues like illness or family problems. We'll be looking at this more closely in just a few moments. British and American diplomats are attempting to find an exit for Pakistan's president before he's dragged through a humiliating impeachment process. There are rumours circulating Pervez Musharraf, a staunch Western ally, is set to quit after suffering a collapse in political support. Government insiders say if Musharraf wants to resign, he must do so before the impeachment proceedings begin, leaving him with only a few days. But his spokesman denied any suggestion he'll step down. Western diplomats are trying to convince the coalition government that impeachment would further undermine the security and political situation in Pakistan, and Musharraf should instead be offered a graceful exit. Zimbabwe's main opposition leaders facing mounting pressure to agree to a power-sharing government with President Robert Mugabe, but Morgan Tsvangirai says any deal must reflect the will of the people. Tsvangirai left talks with Mugabe late on Tuesday, prompting speculation he'd walked out, but in a statement yesterday he said negotiations would continue. In this morning's papers now, The Times interprets the latest developments over Georgia as President Bush squaring up to Vladimir Putin, saying Russia's being warned it could be frozen out of international bodies as punishment. Britain on the brink of recession, says The Telegraph, after the Bank of England's Governor Mervyn King admitted the economy would start to shrink by the end of the year for the first time since the early 90s. The Sun and the Mail report on the man wrongly accused of Rachel Nicole's murder, who's been awarded compensation of £700,000. Colin Stagg says it's like winning the lottery. The Mail says it dwarfs the payout to Rachel's son, who witnessed the killing. And The Sun points out some of the families of victims of the 7/7 terror attacks got less than a tenth of that, making the system a joke. The Mirror asks Peaches Geldof, what have you done? Saying her dad, Sir Bob Geldof, is furious she secretly got married in Las Vegas to a drummer she's only been seeing for a few weeks. Thieves crack chip and pin bank accounts, is the claim in the Express. It goes on to say millions of us are now exposed to the fraud. The paper's back page prints 36 million reasons to stay as Frank Lampard signs a huge deal committing himself to Chelsea for the rest of his career, making him the highest paid player in English football. The Telegraph points out with all that cash he could rent an executive box at West Ham for 1,000 years. As you'd expect, most of the papers carry a picture of Michael Phelps, who yesterday became the most successful Olympian of all time. picking up his 11th career gold medal. And we'll be getting an update from our team in Beijing later in this programme. More on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Watch the news today and you'll likely see plenty of pictures of 18-year-olds gleefully opening their A-level results. It's been another record-breaking year. Results have been improving every year now since 1980. One in four entries will receive an A grade, and the pass rate is edging ever closer to 100%. The Guardian's education editor Polly Curtis says the old arguments have started already. Does this mean standards have dropped?
I think most people are pretty bored of this debate, but it is an important one. Every year for 28 years, the pass rate's gone up. For 17 years, the proportion of A's have gone up. People want to know why. Lots of people will say there's been dumbing down. The schools all argue that it's because of changes in the structure of the A level, which makes it much more accessible to people. That's important. Over a period of time when we've expanded the university system, they need more students. Students need better qualifications to get in. So there's a systematic effect there. It might be easier to get an A now than it was 20 years ago. But you have to get that A. 20 years ago, you could get into a university easily with a C. Now, if you want to go to a top university, you need the A's and the B's. So there's much more pressure on students now, and they have to work a lot harder.
Are companies saying that the students are being taught the right things, or are they still maintaining that they can come out with as many A's as they like, but it doesn't have any relevance to the working life?
Employers and universities both are very critical of the A-levels. They say that A-level candidates don't have the questioning mind that they had 20 years ago. They don't really kind of think for themselves in the same way. And there's an argument that throughout the education system, pupils are being taught the test much more. But at the same time, employers say they don't want the government to reform to the new diploma because at least they know what they've got with the A-levels. So they might be cynical, but they're also rather conservative.
And head teachers, they presumably are saying this is all good news.
They say it's good news. They try and stand up for the poor pupils who have worked so hard and got these brilliant results, and then we have a go at them every year. So I do have a huge amount of sympathy with them. The head teachers will say it's because schools know how to play the system of A-levels. And what changed with A-levels is they used to teach you a load of stuff and then they'd assess you at the end of 2 years. Now they've broken it up into chunks so that people are kind of taken through the subject much more closely, examined at different periods. There's more coursework. So all of those will mean that people will get higher marks, but it also means that they might know a little bit more.
And what about the relationship between state and private schools? Are we seeing the gap widen?
Private schools have always dominated the A's and B's and have a real kind of grip on Oxbridge entries. But it's not just private schools, it's the grammar schools as well. And there's also a kind of Ivy League of top state schools, which are just better than the rest. And there is a big distinction between that group of schools, good schools, and schools which just aren't as good.
How do employers and universities distinguish when one pupil's got three A's and another pupil has got three A's? Who's the better?
They now go into this kind of microscopic detail of their applications, and they go back and look at GCSEs, which is really unfair because, you know, that's something they did when they were 16 and they might have been partying too much or whatever. They also are starting increasingly to ask questions about what school they've gone to. Have they gone to a private school or grammar school, which is used to kind of ploughing kids through the exam system, or have they had to really think for themselves to pass that exam?
And finally then, what options are open to pupils who haven't done as well as they had hoped?
The message from everyone who runs the application system at UCAS is stay incredibly calm today. Don't rush into grabbing the first place you can get through the clearing system today. Take a few days to think about it. Talk to as many admissions tutors as possible. Go to your course of choice first of all and see whether they'll still take you. It's going to be tough this year, but there are lots of places out there and you will get a place.
For more analysis and advice, go to guardian.co.uk/education, where you'll also find a report on how your diet as a child could influence your school performance. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website, is GM farming the environmental disaster Prince Charles claims? guardian.co.uk/environment. Animal rights groups target the Pope's ermine robes, guardian.co.uk/world. and the latest comedy podcast from Edinburgh. guardian.co.uk/Edinburgh.
Olympics 2008 from guardian.co.uk.
This is Mike Adamson on day 6 of the Beijing Olympics. It has been a relatively quiet morning so far in terms of the sport itself. The highlight of the morning programme in the first week is usually the swimming, but without Michael Phelps this morning racing in a final, it was difficult to know where to turn one's attention. The highlight perhaps was Kazuki Kitajima of Japan, who added the 200-metre breaststroke title to the 100-metre breaststroke title he won earlier in the week. This means that he has retained both his titles from 2004 and becomes only the third person to complete such a double-double, together with Michael Phelps and Alexander Popov, the great Russian freestyler. British interest today revolves around Nathan Robertson and Gail Emms, who compete later around about 12:15 British time in the quarterfinals of the badminton. Of course, Emms and Robertson in the first round had a great victory over the world number two and great Chinese hope. And should they win today against the Korean pair, they will go into the semi-finals and look a very good bet for another medal to go with the silver medal they won in 2004. Elsewhere, back in the swimming pool this evening with the heats, Rebecca Adlington, who won the 400-metre freestyle, will be swimming in the 800-metre freestyle heats, and Mark Foster, who carried the British flag at the opening ceremony, will begin his campaign in the 50-metre freestyle. It being a quiet day on the sport front, naturally, attention is turning to the weekend, which is expected to bring a host of medals to Great Britain, particularly in the cycling, the rowing and the sailing. However, Seb Coe, who landed in Beijing earlier this week, told a small selection of journalists today that we should not be expecting too much from our athletes. Indeed, he criticised the way UK athletics has been run since 2004, when, of course, Kelly Holmes won two gold medals and Mark Lewis Francis won a gold medal. Seb Coe said today that that masks the fact that British athletics was actually in disarray and that we do not have many medal hopes. UK Sport has set a target of 5 medals for athletics, but Coe said we would be lucky if we reach such a target. Kelly Southerton, who is one of our great hopes for a gold, one of our very few great hopes for a gold, begins her competition tomorrow in the heptathlon, early on Friday morning. While it has been a quiet morning on the sport front, that was certainly not the case at this morning's BOCOG press conference, BOCOG being the organisers of the Beijing Games. Giselle Davies, who is the IOC's press spokeswoman, and Wang Wei, who is the Secretary General of BOCOG, were repeatedly asked by Western journalists about how they had broken promises made to the IOC back in 2001 when Beijing were awarded the Games, such promises as free press and a lack of sponsorship for journalists who are covering the Games. Of course, yesterday a British journalist was arrested when he tried to cover the protest for free to bet, which took place near the Olympic site. And it has emerged this morning that the parks, which were put aside for protests about Tibet and other matters, have yet to stage one single protest. You'll be able to read more about that story on guardian.co.uk/Olympics. Wang Wei's response to this was that people often come to such events purely to be critical, but that does not mean that we are not fulfilling our promise. Everyone is happy. At this morning's press conference, that last bit certainly was not true.
For the best coverage of the 2008 Games, go to guardian.co.uk/Olympics.
With the death of John McDougall, MP for Glenrothes, Gordon Brown is staring at the prospect of another by-election. Following the massive swing to the SNP in the Glasgow East by-election, what could once be described as a safe Labour seat is no longer such a sure bet, even if it does neighbour Gordon Brown's own constituency of Kirkcaldy and Cowdenbeath. Scotland correspondent Severin Carell says Glenrothes sees itself as an upwardly mobile community, and this election will be a real test to Brown's authority.
Voters in Glenrothes are regarded as being representative of many, many voters in the new times of Scotland. Unlike their parents or even their brothers and sisters, the people that live in the new towns have tend to have left their old communities and have brought with them a different kind of aspiration. So people in Glenrothes are seen widely, generally, as being voters who are upperly mobile are much more interested in their own personal material development rather than being too tied down by family loyalties, you know, to particular parties or to particular communities.
This is a marked change, isn't it, from, let's say, the 1930s to maybe the 1950s. There was a communist MP in Glenrothes. There have been strong anti-monarchist traditions there.
That's correct. Fife has a tradition of being fiercely independent in its politics, and the very powerful trade union and communist movements in the coal mining industries, the shipyard at Rosyth in particular, and also the other heavy industries around the Firth of Forth area and the southwestern part of Fife, certainly led into that, but also in the agricultural sector, which used to be very prominent in Fife. The difference is, of course, is coal mining is now no longer anything like as powerful as it was. Rosyth is now a much, much smaller privatised dockyard. It once employed 30,000, probably employs less than three now. The other issue, of course, is that once with that change have come different kinds of industries. I mean, Glenrothes has quite a high proportion of high-tech defence-related industries. It also has people that, you know, companies that produce set-top boxes for Sky and so on. Some might imagine that defence workers would be leery about voting for a party such as the SNP, which has got quite a strong anti-Trident, anti-Iraq war political platform. But instead, at the moment at least, Glenrothes seems to be quite pro-SNP. Though whether the constituency that John McDougall has left behind will mirror the voting patterns from last May in the Scottish elections remains to be seen. There are parts of the Glenrothes constituency which are still fiercely Labour. We're talking places like Buckhaven, possibly the Weems villages, Cardenden, these kind of villages where the SNP do expect to have quite a fight on their hands.
Well, they seem to think they're favourites, don't they? They came second in 2005. They need a just over 14% swing to win, which these days is not impossible, is it?
Well, after Glasgow East, what isn't possible? The fact of the matter is that when they have a 22% swing in Glasgow East and the constituency, which, at least in very simple terms, has also had a very, very strong and proud Labour history, surely they would imagine themselves as being favourites for Glenrothes. The difference is, of course, is that every by-election does really have to be taken on its own merits, and the difficulty for Labour will be trying to find a local candidate that has the same local recognition and support and roots as McDougall had. Now, there will be a lot of people that will be vying for this seat, and there are some people that will have quite strong claims on it, such as Alex Rowley, who is a very close ally of Gordon Brown, former Labour General Secretary, and now leader of the Labour Group in Fife. There's somebody called Christine May, who was the former sitting MSP. But then Christine May was unseated by Tricia Marwick of the SNP last May. So it's going to be a very close fought campaign, there's no doubt about that.
If Gordon Brown does lose and the SNP do take the Glenrothes seat, can he recover, do you think?
I think it'd be extremely unlikely. I mean, for so many people, the sight of Gordon Brown being the only Labour MP left in Fife, an area which currently has four MPs, used to be three Labour, one Liberal Democrat in Sir Ming Campbell, now reduced simply to Gordon Brown, having probably a Lib Dem on one side of him and an SNP MP on the other side of him. It's going to look dreadful. If he can't maintain political support in Fife, where can he maintain political support? And I think if they lost Glenrothes after losing Glasgow East, people will really, really be demanding somebody else takes over in the party leadership.
More on that story at guardian.co.uk/politics.
From guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
And while the Prime Minister faces an uncertain future, the man who would be Prime Minister is facing an embarrassing report from a right-leaning think tank. David Cameron is playing down the conclusion of the Policy Exchange, which claims that some cities in the north are beyond revival and residents should just move down south. It says port cities such as Liverpool and Sunderland have lost their raison d'etre, that regeneration won't work and people should migrate en masse to London, Cambridge and Oxford to avoid being trapped in poverty. Guardian's Northern editor Martin Wainwright joined Mr. Cameron in Cumbria.
I've come to Carlisle, where David Cameron is starting his tour of the Northwest today. Not an easy day for him because of the think tank report suggesting that northern cities such as Liverpool and Sunderland should effectively close down and everybody in them move to the south. It's a curious view of the north, and one that David Cameron has just comprehensively rubbished on his arrival here at a youth employment centre where he's going to join a class of young people being encouraged to get ready for work, find work. He said that the author of the port himself had said it was slightly balmy, and Cameron very much agreed with that, said it was rubbish from start to finish. Could I ask, although this report is balmy, isn't it rather worrying that people in the capital can come up with such outlandish ideas about the North? I mean, I don't know if this man has ever been up here.
I've no idea. I gather he's off to Australia, and I think the sooner he gets on the ship, the better. Look, of course, it's a free country. People are free to come up with balmy ideas, but it doesn't mean that they should be adopted by anyone, least of all by me.
And can I just ask you, for my birthday treat, I went to Chalbury in your constituency, and just thinking this morning, I thought, would people around there want a whole load of us to come down and build our houses in that part of the world?
I think if people who, you know, I represent, as you say, Chalbury in Oxfordshire, and there's huge pressure of development, and it's, as you say, it's not always very popular. What we need to do is to make sure we continue to regenerate our cities, to make them better places to live, and by doing that, we can actually improve life in those cities and also take the pressure off Greenbelt and Greenfield development.
And very last question, the regional development agencies, I think, up here are seen as important drivers of what's gone on in the last 20 years, and perhaps go back to Heseltine and everything. Are they safe when you come to buy?
I think that what we should have is not a one-size-fits-all policy. I know that in the Northwest and also in the Northeast, the regional development agency is quite popular. I have to say, in the southeast of England, the regional development agency isn't very popular and is seen as rather wasteful. So where they work, they should stay. I think that's a very sensible approach.
David Cameron talking to The Guardian's Northern editor, Martin Wainwright. I'm Mike Duran. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, we go prospecting for gold north of Glasgow.
In a tonne of rock, you will probably produce enough gold to manufacture a normal-style wedding band.
Now, if you were wondering how best to bond the generations, just look to the television. A new Ofcom report suggests that teenagers have similar watching habits to people who've retired, though teenagers are less likely to watch the news. The report also shows a lack of knowledge on the environmental impact of having a house full of the latest gadgets. Ofcom's Director of Market Research, James Thicket, has been going through the figures for us.
What is really striking about this report is how much is changing in all these markets that we're surveying. 2007 saw higher take-up of communication services across the board. Nearly 9 out of 10 homes have digital TV. Nearly 6 out of 10 now have broadband. Over a quarter have a DAB digital radio. And people are actually spending more time using these services than ever before. Our calculation is that it's about 7 hours and 9 minutes a day, which is up. It's mainly up through additional use of mobile phones and the internet. From 2002 to 2007, the time spent talking and texting on mobiles has actually doubled to around 10 minutes a day. And time spent on the internet has quadrupled to 24 minutes a day. So people are using these services more than ever before. But at the same time, they're actually paying less than ever before.
Now, 7 in 10 people say they care about the environment. And when buying a fridge, we do consider the impact on the environment, but not, it seems, when we're buying a television.
Yes, I mean, 2/3 of us claim that we turn off our devices to save energy. And one of the interesting things about this whole sector is that there isn't the same level of awareness or understanding of environmental issues that you do have in markets like white goods or motor vehicles. And so, for instance, we found that many people, in fact more than half of us, decide to leave our set-top boxes on standby when not in use. We're actually pretty good at turning our TV off at night, but when it comes to things like wireless routers and set-top boxes, there's still a long way to go.
And the equivalent of not turning off those set-top boxes and leaving the mobile on for too long, what would that be in cups of tea, for example?
Well, we did a rough and ready back of an envelope calculation. If everybody in this country with a set-top box left it on every night, it would be the equivalent of 80 billion cups of tea in the UK, the same amount of electricity to make 80 billion cups of tea.
As I understand it, more and more of us are buying DAB, but most of us don't realise that they use 20 to 30 times more electricity than the standard FM radio.
Well, this is one of the issues that we're seeing in awareness of what's going on in our marketplace, because people aren't aware of the different energy consumption of different devices. It's an area that is ripe for better understanding and better education.
But shouldn't you, as the watchdog, be telling manufacturers to be building these new radios that, you know, they shouldn't be using so much electricity? Is that within your remit?
Well, our remit is not to wag fingers at people or companies in terms of the environmental impact of what they're doing, but it's to promote a better understanding and appreciation of these issues. And certainly we expect manufacturers to communicate these issues either at point of sale or in the various promotional materials when they're selling these devices. But I think what we're trying to do at the moment is to raise awareness of the fact that there isn't as much as great understanding around communications devices as there is in other areas like cars or fridge freezers.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
Finally today, north of Glasgow is a derelict gold mine. It's been newly reopened because the price of gold has recently shot up, making it a viable proposition. The concern for investors is that the price of gold is on its way back down again. An Australian-backed mining company believes there are at least 4.5 tonnes of gold, currently worth £80 million, throughout the Grampian Mountains. Severin Carell has put on his hard hat for The Guardian.
What we can see here, this stretch of quartz we can see running above the tracks, this is what you're going to mine?
This is indeed what we're going to mine. It's a bit like the ham in a vertical ham sandwich. We leave the white bread and take out the ham from the middle. It's a sort of thin sliver running through vertically through the rock here. And yeah, this is indeed what we're after.
And how do you actually get that gold out? I mean, this isn't like going in with a pickaxe and suddenly finding a great big chunk of gold, is it, and then just putting in your back pocket and walking out?
No, our gold is very, very finely distributed. It's very, very small particles contained within the quartz rock. Once we've mined it, which would be done by drilling and blasting, it's taken to surface, and then basically the rock is ground down into a fine sand or slurry and then processed to release the gold. Some of the gold, because it has a high specific gravity, is recovered through what we call gravity concentration processes. And in our particular deposit, the rest of the gold is associated with the other base metal sulfides that occur here. And we remove those from the rock and then send them off to a smelter to recover the gold.
How much gold would you get per tonne of rock?
The average grade of the deposit is around 11 or 12 grams, as we know at the moment, with about 40 to 50 grams of silver. To put that into perspective, in a ton of rock, you will probably produce enough gold to manufacture a normal style wedding band. Or if you look at a cubic meter of rock, you will have 3 to 4 wedding bands in the cubic meter.
If you're wearing a gold ring on your finger, how much work does it take to get that gold out of here?
That probably is about 8 grams or 10 grams of gold, which is about a third of an ounce. Normal sort of processing costs would be $200, $300, $400 an ounce. The amount of work that's required to do that is firstly some physical labour to drill and blast it. Then you have to take it out of the mine. Then you have to crush it down into a fine pulp, recover the gold, then smelt it, refine it, and eventually it gets made into a gold bar and distributed to jewellers. So it's quite a long and arduous process to get the ring on the finger out.
Get something for that happy day.
Yep, indeed.
The Colonish mine that we're looking at now and that we're standing in at the moment is just the beginning of what could be quite a large gold field for you.
That's what we believe. We have Crown licences extending for 2,200 square kilometres over this central belt of rocks in Scotland. This area is very prospective for gold.
Is there a new gold rush about to hit the Southern Highlands?
We hope so.
That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. Our panoply of producers today, Phil Maynard, Sonia Rothwell and Andy Duckworth. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.